This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly, the Champions League. Liverpool bring in some youngsters, but are too much for a disappointing AC Milan, opening the door for Atleti to Atleti their way past Porto. City lose, but win their group. Clearly Kyle Walker didn't fancy playing in the last 16. Real top their group with a simple win over Inter. Great news for the Sebastian Haller is terrific society as well. In the Premier League, Damari Gray hammers one home in injury time to ease the pain on Rafa. Meanwhile, Tottenham have COVID. There's an exciting FA Cup third round draw for me. And of course, your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Lars Sivertsen, welcome.
Good morning, Max. How's it going?
I'm very good. Jonathan Faduba, welcome.
Good morning.
And from the Racing Post, Mark Langdon. Hello, Mark.
Hi, Max.
Many questions for you, Mark. We'll get to them at the end. They are mainly Christmas dinner based. I believe we've done them before, but you know, why waste an annual tradition?
Do you want me to just sort of mute for an hour while Jonathan and Lars go through the football?
Listen, I think you've got something to give with the football, I'll be honest. It might not be what you're here for, but I'm happy for you to stay. Devil's Finger says, do you not ever practice fake press conferences, pods, and joke about things that football managers deny have happened, despite evidence to the contrary? Gray72, can you confirm if Football Weekly had a Christmas party last year, and if you didn't, that all rules were followed at the party that didn't happen? I believe, Lars, you were on the Christmas party pod, and I think we can confirm that it was very much socially distanced.
Well, yeah, it was tremendously socially distanced. I had the very dignified experience of sort of like drinking in the morning in my home office space alone, which I think it came across as more jolly on the pod than it actually felt in the moment. I mean, as I sat there, I thought this seemed like a better idea when we were planning it on the WhatsApp. Like sitting in, it felt a bit sad, I have to say. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's worth pointing out that there are rumours that Barry Glendening and Jonathan Wilson sat on the same bench on Christmas Day. We can't confirm if they did or they didn't sit on the bench. And if they did sit on the bench, they were socially distant. And if they didn't sit on the bench, it doesn't matter. Yes, Lars?
And I have to also say that there's a lot of speculation after last night, but we've thought about it. And the Sebastian Haller is terrific society, of course known as the shits, are definitely not having a Christmas party this year, though there may be an entirely work-related meeting of the Sebastian Haller is terrific society. I mean, more as we get it.
Fantastic. And if there is any breaking news, do interrupt, Lars. I know you like to do that. Let's start at the San Siro. Liverpool had never played at the San Siro before. That surprised me. They won this game 2-1, or in competitive football, I should say, which means the first English side to win all six of their group games, a very changed side. I wonder if the story, Mark, is more how disappointing AC Milan were.
Yeah, I suppose they were. I mean, there was an opportunity there to beat Liverpool, given the back four that Jurgen Klopp picked. Individually, you know, they're all nothing wrong with them as players, but collectively, you did wonder about just sort of throwing in sort of four names like that, particularly when sort of defensive organisation is very much a collective sort of part of what Jurgen Klopp does with Liverpool. But I think from Milan's point of view, that they maybe, even right from match day one, I'm not sure they really truly believed in themselves in this group the whole way through. Even, you know, there was big excitement when they lost 3-2 at Anfield, for instance, and, you know, were quite comprehensively outplayed at times, but they just sort of felt happy to be back in the competition rather than, this is a competition we can go far in. I think they realised pretty early on that there's bigger fish to fry for them in terms of making sure that they first get back into the competition next season. And also, you know, they're very much in the title race at the moment in Italy. And, this was just maybe a group that was too strong for them in this part of their development. I know Liverpool made the group look very easy, but, that's just down to the brilliance of Liverpool. If you have a look at the other two teams in there, I think it was always going to be difficult for Milan.
I mean, Salah and Mane both started, but it was quite a changed side. Lars, am I wrong to kind of extrapolate from this game and and make some sort of sweeping statement. We know the Premier League is much richer than Serie A, but like that much of a change, Liverpool side comfortably beating, even if it's only 2-1, the team that are top in Serie A. Like, should I be having an existential crisis about the future of football, or should I have been had that years ago?
Of course, we should all have existential crises about that. But we can separate that from this match. I've felt sort of slightly defensive about Milan throughout this tournament because even though they are top of Serie A, there is a sense that this is still kind of a little bit of a work in progress. There's a old man Ibra gets the headlines, but there's quite a lot of young and or relatively inexperienced players in this group. But having said all that, yeah, this was quite poor. I mean, yes, you know, Salah and Mane started, but I think a midfield of Oxlade-Chamberlain, Minamino and Morton, you'd expect sort of Kessié and Tonali and Brahim Diaz to get more out of them, really, in this sort of game. So this was very, very disappointing for Milan. And they seemed weirdly flat, given that, you know, there was a lot more at stake for them here, really, than for Liverpool. And you didn't get that sense from the game at all. So, yeah, this was disappointing.
Jonathan, Tyler Morton, I presume you've been tracking his progress for years and years. He looks like another one of these sort of Liverpool clones. I think it was it Jamie Carragher who called them that? It just incredibly comfortable on the ball, taking the ball in tight spaces, you know, more experienced players passing to him in tight areas.
Yeah, he did pretty well. I don't think you can really take too many conclusions in terms of this individual performance because, of course, he's, you know, in a really good team. And, you know, there's been players who've come through at Liverpool, the likes of Ben Woodburn, and we've kind of raved about them and then not really seen them again. And I think probably you just have to let him settle into the team and judge it and take a view of that a bit later. I mean, I was quite disappointed with AC Milan, and I think that, you know, Mark's point about being worried, I think there is a cause to be worried because, I mean, they're top of Serie A and Liverpool have just dispatched them comfortably. I didn't really buy the kind of hype when people were saying this is like the group of death and things like that. I kind of thought that was massively overplayed. I mean, Milan are 39th in the UEFA club coefficient rankings. They're behind like Eintracht Frankfurt, Zenit, Dinamo Zagreb. So this is a Milan that's kind of really not the team it was. And then obviously you've got a Porto side that didn't even win the league last season in Portugal. So, you know, Sporting are the main big dogs at the moment in that league in terms of champions. You know, Milan were 12 points behind the champions last season as well in their league. So I think, yeah, the two conclusions I had from this, I mean, obviously we know Liverpool are really, really good. And I think they'll be one of the favourites for both the Premier League and the Champions League. But my main conclusion from this game was kind of it's quite worrying for European football as a whole because I think the Premier League is just so far ahead now. And you kind of saw that in, you know, the goal scorer, for example, Tomori, a player that Chelsea have an option on if they want him back, I believe, and didn't really, you know, obviously they let him go. We're quite happy to let him go. And just all in all, it was a kind of, yeah, as Mark said, when you look at the lineup Liverpool put out and then to win in the San Siro, I mean, the San Siro, you know, I remember being there to watch like Kaká many years ago and such a amazing place to watch football, see football, and just it seems like a real decline of Milan, and it's I thought it was quite sad to see, really. So yeah, things to think about for the.
You're sad about it. You're sad about it, like you were sad about the existential crisis you had when Neymar was 30 and, yeah, and that hit you. I just want to confirm for the record that I have never raved about Ben Woodburn, but when we're all allowed and I'm back in the country for a live show, perhaps we'll have the Ben Woodburn rave.
Maybe that'll be the next halftime spectacular, just a Ben Woodburn themed rave.
Raman says Zlatan felt like a 70-year-old man on the pitch. Why is he starting for AC Milan? Does that give Barry hope he can start for a top flight team and show the world his volley skills are on a par with Thiago Alcantara? He did look, I mean, he didn't get the service, Jonathan, but I was thinking about that crisis you were having about Neymar and wondered if you were having a separate one about Zlatan.
Plenty of crises going around at the moment. No, I think Zlatan, obviously, he's an old lion, isn't he? He likes to call himself a lion and he's definitely aging. I think it's a testament to his staying power because, you know, he's been around the block, really, and probably maybe Serie A kind of suits him in the fact it's a little bit slower. You know, you can't really expect Zlatan to be doing what he did in the past because he was such a, I think his biggest skill was kind of how he manipulates his body. I mean, everyone obviously remembers that goal against England and you know, just he's so flexible in that sense. So, you know, when you just get a bit older, like, you can't expect him to be at the same level he was. Probably didn't quite have the service as well and is playing against a Liverpool side that is very, very aggressive in how they press and close people down. So, you know, it's probably difficult to find spaces, things like that. So, no, I don't feel too sad about Zlatan, and he's had an amazing career. So, you know, you can't really knock him. But I think even the fact that he's the main...
Oh, I can knock Zlatan. I find him really annoying. But
well, you
anyway.
Say that. You've moved to Australia. I mean, you have a safe distance.
Yeah. I've
We're
got
still
braver.
Within
I have
reach.
Got braver.
Yeah, definitely.
Even the fact he's the main striker in that team kind of sums up, kind of made you where just where Milan are at the moment, I think. So yeah, that kind of goes back to the original point, I suppose.
Darren says, is Nat Phillips the best defender to ever play at the San Siro? Hashtag Bolton Barrasia. This is based, I think, on one lovely turn he did away from two Milan attackers. Mikey says, has Divock Origi ever scored an inconsequential goal? I mean, this was pretty inconsequential for Liverpool. Well, look, both his and Salah's goals were good finishes. Liverpool were already through, of course. This group was there for the taking. Milan losing meant it was between Porto and Atleti. Jake says, should Atleti v Porto be forced to play on the final match day of every Champions League group stage? Also, what's the proper term for a match so shithouse that Pepe is trying to calm things down? Ian, lots of records falling tonight, but surely the best is the biggest number of respect bib wearers to have been involved in a mass bout of handbags. Beyond the goals, Lars, there was an absolutely exceptional 8 minutes from the Carrasco sending off to Mr. Wendell getting sent off, I thought very unfairly. And it was just, it was sort of heavenly touchline broad. Like both fouls were right by the opposition dugout, like perfectly placed for the most number of people to get involved. It had everything.
It was tremendous. And it was one of those when the commentators start going, well, we don't like to see this, but come on. We do like to see this. We 100% like to see this. It was good fun. I'm with you, though. I was quite cross that Wendell was sent off in the end because that was a bit of a nonsense. But it was tremendous. It was brawl-tastic. There were two, I mean, you know, Porto, Atleti and Diego Simeone, you know, the sort of spiritual kings of shithousery the world over, I think we all agree. But Porto are a sort of a low-key shithousy team with some real shithousy pedigree. I mean, going all the way back to Mourinho's Porto, fantastically shithousy group of players who whenever they were in the lead, would just make falling down into an art form. And really, there's some true... I mean, we're talking about football heritage, Max. The heritage of shithousing in this team is pretty strong. So two of the heavyweights coming together and it produced a pretty spectacular bout.
I should say for the kids listening, I will tell Lars that he has reached his shit quota for even before we've got to Sebastian Haller on today's podcast. Language develops.
Okay.
We'd like to apologise if you are, of course, offended by Lars Siverton. We all are. That Wendell moment, Mark, isn't that what VAR is for? Because the referee, obviously, you can't expect any official, you can't expect four officials to see what's going on because there's just so many people flying about. But like, he didn't foul someone. He tackled them and it was kind of aggressive. He sort of gets pushed and he lifts his arm, but he doesn't elbow the guy in the face and he elbows him near the bottom, the top of his neck, and he goes down holding his forehead and you're just like, oh, Porto, you knew Atleti were going to try and get you down to 10 men too and you've fallen into the trap.
Well, they tried in the first half as well. I think three players went down holding their face in the first half. So it was clearly something that Atletico had felt, was part of the game plan, at least to try to get a Porto player sent off even before Carrasco was. Totally agree that it wasn't a red card. And I felt that VAR was going to overturn it. And so did Wendell, who stayed on the pitch a little bit longer than...
that was so good, wasn't it? Just there running around.
I don't know if he was just sort of hoping the ref hadn't seen that he was still on the pitch. Then that really confused the sort of commentators that were doing it off tube. Who, I don't. They didn't know what was going on either. It was, I think, it was harsh on Wendell. I think it was a harsh result on Porto as well. They, you know, for 50 odd minutes, they'd been the better team. I'm not saying they were battering Atletico, but they were creating all of the chances. Didn't deal with a set piece. And, you know, Atletico just got their moment. It was it was probably the most Atletico game that you're ever going to see, right from, like I say, really early on in that first half. I think it was Coque or Rodrigo de Paul just went down holding their face for no particular reason. Suarez was in tears in the first half at his injury. What you would say, though, is that Atletico were missing a lot of players. I mean, they went into that with, you know, Kondogbia, Fasalco, Hermoso sort of, you know, in the defence, and, you know, it was missing all of their sort of key centre-backs, you would have thought, and that they've still managed to find a way through.
Ooh, whose doorbell was that?
That will be the first of many, Max, today. The amount of people that deliver stuff to this house is just incredible. Right.
And do you know what you've ordered, Mark, or is this for family Langdon? Is it just meat? It's just meat arriving left, right and centre.
the butcher's come with the first load of the day.
Here we are. The cow carcass arrives. Jonathan, we love to hate Atleti, right? So I sort of felt annoyed at the time that they'd got through, but now I'm pleased I get to see them in the last 16.
Yeah, I don't hate Atleti at all. I quite like them. I like their commitment to just being the bad boys of kind of European football. I mean, even when you look at the stats, as Mark said, you know, Porto, 68% possession, 10 chances created. They'd all to play 434 accurate passes. Atletico had 160 passes, but a 3.38 XG, 32% possession and 6 big chances created. So literally, we don't want the ball, but we're just going to be super, super efficient when we've got it. And see you later. We're going to take our qualification. We're out of here. Simeone is a, you know, he's a character, and I really like this Atletico side in terms of, you know, what he, and I think I read something saying, I think this is the 8th time they've come out of the group stages roughly since he's joined the club. And before he joined, in the last 20 years before that, they'd only qualified twice from the Champions League group stages. So we kind of maybe sort of don't appreciate enough the consistency he's had at that club over many years. You know, he's won titles there, he's done everything there really. So yeah, this had a really Copa Libertadores sort of feel to the game, definitely in all the all we needed was someone to sort of get pushed by the ref and fall over and sort of roll around injured, and then it would have been complete Libertadores classic.
Yeah, this was some true Libertadores vibes. I mean, on Lendl, surprising if Lendl turned up.
Yes,
if
picking Ivan Lendl at right back, yeah. I would say was Porto's
that
mistake.
Really backfired there. For Porto. Yeah, now on Wendl, who I agree, I think he was very unfortunate to be sent off, but it was also very rash. I mean, in his first 3 seasons in the Bundesliga, after moving to Leverkusen early in his career, he picked up 29 yellow cards. Which is prodigious.
In one season?
In 3.
In 3,
in one season, that would be impossible, I think.
It would, yeah. Amazing.
But I still think over 3 seasons, 29 yellow cards is a pretty prodigious rate of bookings. And I think he's had something like 4 yellows in just 3 starts for Porto. I mean, he's had 3 off the bench as well. So he is a card-tastic player, Wendell is, who maybe needs to settle down a bit.
Let's go to Group D. Real Madrid and Inter were already through. It was all about who topped the group and Real Madrid do. Two lovely goals, Mark. Toni Kroos and Asensio's was an utter delight. There was some more madness when Barella just... Who challenged him on the sideline?
Militao.
It was Militao, yeah. Militao sort of shoulder-barged him into the hoarding. And he's like... Barella's like... The funny thing about that was he punched Militao in the leg and then crawled through his legs.
Yeah.
Really weird.
It's like some sort of very strange UFC move. Like, yeah. From his fighting name would be Little Badger or something. Like, never know where he is.
My question to you, I guess, is how, you know, Real have won this group, Inter a second. They feel to me like it wouldn't be a terrible draw for anyone who got either of them. Is that accurate or not?
I think in terms of group winners, I think that, you know, Real Madrid have got a very illustrious name, but if you were, I would expect sort of all of the, well, maybe not Manchester United, I would comfortably expect the other 3 English teams to have dealt with Real Madrid if they were to have got them in the last 16. Obviously, they haven't, but it's not as bad as getting sort of a Man City or something in the last 16 if you do finish second. As far as Inter are concerned, I think they're a dangerous team. You know, if you look at, I know they've just been beaten 2-0 by Real Madrid, but I still don't think you'd be over the moon at sort of drawing them in, you know, if you've won the group. They are, I think, the best team in Italy this season. they were beaten in this game by, as you mentioned, Max, just two fantastic goals. The Asensio one particularly off, was just spectacular, the way that that one flew in off the post. So I think that maybe Inter are a little bit better than this showing and this score suggests. But for a long time now, they haven't actually played that well in Europe. And I'm not quite sure why that is. They've got very good players. I think their team's a little bit chaotic, and maybe that's not suited to European football in terms of whether they're good enough defensively. So two names, I think, that you're not going to be absolutely gutted if you draw them. But particularly Inter, I don't think you'd be sort of cheering on getting them in the last 16 personally.
Shakhtar won, Sheriff won. So Sheriff were already into the Europa League. So well done to them. And that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin with Group A, Man City and PSG. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly then. So Group A, Manchester City win the group. PSG second. Man City lost to RB Leipzig. The most interesting part of this game was Lars Kyle Walker. What's he doing? It's a very odd thing to do.
You keep watching it over and over again. I think, why? I mean, it's a game that doesn't matter, and you just kicked a fella for no reason. It's a very strange behavior from a professional footballer. But I suppose, listen, he didn't have a great game. I'm sure he was a bit frustrated. And he just decided, I'm going to kick a fella. And there's no need for that. And he is now banned for the next game.
Is he definitely one game? Because I heard it could be two.
I think they're still to decide. It could be one or two. UEFA kind of look at these red card decisions and then...
Right. And is it based on stupidity of challenge? Unnecessary nature of challenge?
I feel like they should add another one just for the sheer boneheadedness of it. I mean, it's remarkable. But also a timely reminder. And for those of us who watched quite a lot of Kyle Walker in his younger days, I mean, it is something to see him develop into quite extraordinary right back, which he has done. This was a reminder that he is still fundamentally deep down Kyle Walker.
Mark, tell us a bit about RB Leipzig sacking Jesse Marsch and what are they going to do, and if that was a surprise at all.
I don't think it was a surprise that they sacked him. I think he came with a big reputation and rightly so, I think, because the sort of Salzburg team had played really exciting football, and it felt like the next step up. And, you know, this is the way that Red Bull, you know, work. They've got like this factory, and, you know, you start in Austria and then you work your way up into the German set up. If you go that way, they've also, you know, got teams in America and Brazil and various other places. And, you know, they do like to sort of move players and coaches around because, you know, and I think that there's an efficiency to that. I feel a little bit sorry for Jesse Marsch. First of all, they were drawn in a nightmare Champions League group with Manchester City and Paris Saint-Germain, which was always going to make it difficult to qualify. And there was always the potential to get thrashed in some of those games because of the quality those two teams have got. I also think that they maybe just sold one too many in the summer. Konate and Upamecano, you know, your two centre-backs both going in the same summer, it probably isn't the wisest move, I wouldn't have thought. And then you lose somebody like Sabitzer as well, just a real experienced head, and Julian Nagelsmann, the coach, as well. So that, I think, is always going to take some time to recover. I know that their Bundesliga form hasn't been brilliant, but in my opinion, you know, there are reasons for that, and I hope that Jesse Marsch gets another opportunity in Europe, because it's another US coach that's been sort of suggested, is good enough, and then gets an opportunity, and it hasn't worked out for him. But I think there are mitigating circumstances for Leipzig's sort of indifferent Bundesliga form this season.
PSG 4, Club Brugge 1. Is it fair to say, Jonathan, that PSG are better when only two of the three are playing?
Yeah, I think you're probably right on that. I don't want to go into another Neymar existential crisis thing, but I really feel for him.
No, please do. I enjoyed the last one.
He's had so many injuries since he's moved to PSG. And if you saw the challenge, there's certain games in Ligue 1 where basically they get to a certain point with Neymar and they're like, you know what, we're just going to take this guy out of the game. And they just go for the ankles, sort of ankle biters, like really nasty challenges, to be honest. He's had a lot of bad injuries on really nasty tackles that I think make me question kind of the move there, you know, in the sense that he's so much better than the level of some of the defenders that they kind of get to a point where they feel embarrassed by him and they decide to take it out on him. And it's happened 3-4 times. And as I said, I think in the last show it's kind of damaged his career, really. So going back to the point of that, yeah, him sort of not being there means that there's a bit more balance, because then Pochettino's not forced to play, obviously, the three of them in Neymar, Mbappe and Messi. And that just adds a little bit more balance, because you can bring maybe a bit more defensive-minded attacking midfielder or someone like that into the side. So I think you can make that argument. It speaks to the fact that obviously you've got to get balance in football. That's something to be positive about. You can't just buy a club, fill it with the best players in the world and win everything. It's not that simple. You have to get certain players. You know, you need your kind of, you need your Herreras or whatever to balance things out at certain points. So that's the thing. But of course, when you've got Mbappe and Messi, you know, you've got an incredible two there anyway that can win most games if you give them the ball and put it in the areas that they want to. So in a sense, you can argue that, you know, you can, if you have too many of these kind of Galactico type players, then you can ruin the balance. So yeah, you're probably right, Max.
You sound surprised. I was listening to your friend.
We are.
I was listening to your friend of mine, Andy Brassel, on the absolutely scintillating Australian television coverage of the Champions League. And he was saying that you can't not pick them all if they're all fit. Could a game like this, I know it's only Bruges, give Pochettino the power to whoever, I presume he has the power, to tell himself you can pick Di Maria because that helps, he's more creative in a different way, or not?
No, I don't think so. And I think that's the main problem with PSG, really. I think they're a very political club in the sense of, yeah, you can't really leave out any of the three, to be honest.
But why can't I do that? Why, I mean, I'm the manager of PSG. Why can't I pick the team I want to pick? Who's yelling at me? Who is
the entourage? Who is that? The entourage of one of Neymar, Mbappe, or Messi, pretty much. And you got to bear in mind as well, you've got Mbappe on an expiring contract. He's available next summer on a free. Can't really upset him too much if you're trying to keep him happy and get him on a new contract, which they desperately want. You got Neymar, mm-hmm. who basically, I mean, he feels entitled to be there and starting, but he pretty much does in the sense of, obviously, if he's not playing, it's a massive story. And then Messi is Messi, so you can't really leave him out either. And I think that's the issue with PSG, and that's always the source of kind of tension. There's obviously other things going on behind the scenes, like the relationship between Leonardo and his managers. You know, Thomas Tuchel was another one where, you know, he did an incredible job to get them to the Champions League final, I thought, and then kind of got sacked pretty much a few months after that, which was, you know, I still can't believe that to this day. And, you know, the reasons for that were kind of political. Again, Tuchel's got his own way of doing things. He wanted certain things and he couldn't get it, and he couldn't win that player power battle. And Pochettino's in the same situation. So it's a difficult club to really judge managers, I think, PSG, in a way. You're kind of, you got one hand behind your back, and it's hard to actually say, is this a good manager, or is he kind of not actually allowed to do what he wants to do? And I think that's the seed behind the reasons that Pochettino's not 100% probably happy at PSG, if the reports are to be believed. Because, you know, if you're like a big manager like that, you want to stamp your own ideas on teams. But when you know that kind of you leave one player out, you're going to have 10 to 15 people knocking on your door. And it can even be with people within the club as well. Then that kind of causes issues itself. And that just makes it harder to manage everything, really. So, yeah, it's a difficult one.
Yeah, I guess the only thing I'd add is that the problem isn't so much that they're knocking at your door. The problem is that they'll knock on the owners' doors. You know, they'll bypass you altogether, which I guess is the core problem, really, of the team. I guess what I would like to see is, when it comes to the knockouts, Pochettino might as well do what he wants. Because if they're not, like, if he doesn't get them to a final, or at very, very least a semi-final, he's probably going to get sacked anyway, or it's going to be seen as a failure. So you might as well just go YOLO and just play the team you want.
That'd be great. In the pre-match interviews, if just that's what he said, just one to Des Kelly, and he just YOLO. Went YOLO. Dan says, is Clinton Matter the best football manager regen name out there at the moment, playing right back for Bruges? I don't know if any of you have any better ones currently doing the rounds. I mean, in real Championship Manager, I had Ken Weggerly scoring hundreds of goals for me, and he was really good. But Clinton Matter is pretty special.
Last time I played Football Manager, I had a sort of generated youngster turned up called Steve Eto'o.
Oh, good.
Which I thought was good. I felt that the algorithm had messed up a little bit there. I was kind of expecting to Nigel Drogba and sort of Tarquin Essien to follow.
Oh, that's really good. I had Roger Miller, but M-I-L-L-E-R, like old English version of Roger Miller. Anyway, let's go to Group C. Ajax winning all their games, scored 20, conceded just 5 in the Champions League group stages. First Dutch side to win 6 out of 6. Sebastian Aller getting his 10th goal of the competition, equaling Ronaldo's record by scoring in all of the games. How good are they, Mark? And people making comparisons to 2019 Ajax. It's hard to judge, isn't it? Or is it? Is it easy to judge? They look good.
Yeah, I think it is hard to judge at the moment because, yeah, the Eredivisie is a weak league, and Ajax have such a sort of financial advantage that means that, you know, they are going to win most games and they're not going to be tested, particularly defensively. I like what they do going forward, but you only really know about them defensively when they play against elite teams. The way that they hammered Borussia Dortmund in the first game particularly, I think was a really good sign. I suppose in the return game against Dortmund had quite a few injuries and then had an early red card that, again, I thought was quite harsh. And so we are still waiting, I think, to find their level. And I think they're a really difficult team, to pitch where they are in the European pecking order at the moment. Certainly just sort of, you know, looking at them, and you can only sort of judge them on what they're beating. Outside of the obvious teams, they look like one of the next best. I mean, like, for instance, we were talking about Real Madrid and Inter earlier on. I mean, I think Ajax look better than both of those, but it's whether they're then able to do it when they're having to step up. Now, they did do that, for the most part in 2019, when, of course, you know, they took out some real big names, Real Madrid and Juventus included, and obviously should have won the semi-final as well. I feel like this team has the potential to be better, actually. There is that caveat of we just don't quite know. So I can't be fully all in, but Haller is somebody I'm sure Lars will get to, but you know, Anthony is a wider player that I really enjoy watching whenever he's playing. I know he's a little bit inconsistent, but I'm sure that there's a big team for him pretty soon, and he's not the only one.
A word on Haller then, Lars, go on.
He's terrific.
More, maybe 5 or 10 words.
I guess the point I'd make with Ajax is I wonder if they've been slightly aided by the sort of financial troubles of European football the last couple of years. So I do think a couple of the players here, obviously they have money now as a club because they sold really well, but I think still they'd come under pressure to maybe let some of them go. I think there would have been offers from the sort of for guys like Anthony, guys like Neres, and well, there's only really one Anthony and one Neres, but you know, those two, for instance, would have maybe been looking to move, but it's been easier for Ajax to keep a hold of players because of the finances have been in European football the last couple of years, and that's something that's been positive for them. And I was really blown away with them in the home game against Dortmund, I think it was, which is when I sat down to watch, like, I'm going to watch the full 90 minutes and really pay attention and see what because I expected them kind of go, you know, okay, now they're meeting a very good team with Erling Haaland and everything, and it'll go very badly wrong for them. And instead, they completely blew Dortmund away. So I think they're very, very good.
The coach is fantastic. Erik ten Hag, he definitely has got, I mentioned Anthony, he's definitely got a big club in him whenever he wants to leave, for sure. Mm-hmm.
So Ajax and Sporting through, which means Dortmund are in the Europa League. They beat Besiktas 5-0. Erling Braut Haaland came off the bench in the 63rd minute, scored a couple, 23 goals in 19 Champions League appearances. Nice to see him back. Dortmund, Jonathan, are in the Europa League, along with Porto, Leipzig, one of Atalanta and Villarreal, maybe Barcelona, who knows, from Group G. Some good teams in the Europa League dropping down.
Yeah, very good teams. They're not going to be too happy about it. I think there's there's going to be a lot of disappointed players, I think. I mean, you look at Haaland, like he's not going to want to be sticking around in the Europa League. So that's, for Dortmund, that's potentially really, I mean, he's probably maybe going to be, you know, the plan maybe was to let him leave at the end of the season anyway, but that's probably going to seal it if you look at it really. I mean, you know, it's very disappointing for him. He's such a Champions League, you know, he lives for the big games, and you can kind of tell by the way he plays. So I think that's probably for him a precursor to leaving. Barcelona's going to be an interesting one to see what happens there, because, you know, that Barcelona Champions League would be amazing. In the Europa League would be amazing, really. Just going back to Ajax, if I can, yeah, I think they're the real deal. They've got the highest expected goals in the competition so far, fourth highest possession, 18 points. I really, really like them. And there's a few other players, Peer Schurz and Gravenberch as well, that I think I agree with Lars on that point, that, you know, they've not had to sell those kind of players that probably would have been sold before their time. So, and I also agree with Mark on Ten Hag. I think he's going to have his pick of clubs when he eventually does leave. But yeah, it's probably a bit too early to talk about the Europa League, because we don't know exactly who's in it. But one other thing, by the way, Sporting, they've done really, really well. They've got a good manager as well to get out of that group. So I've got to give them a bit of credit as well.
Thank you for doing so. Tottenham have all got COVID. David Heitner in The Guardian saying at least half a dozen first team players have been affected, plus members of the coaching staff. Has seen the club open talks with the league over the viability of cancelling the Brighton game. Antonio Conte took training on Tuesday morning. UEFA has said that the Ren tie is due to take place as scheduled in the Europa Conference. According to its rules, as long as the club has at least 13 senior players available, including at least one goalkeeper, games must go ahead. While we're on COVID, Mateo Kovacic returned a positive COVID test on Tuesday. And last week, the Premier League had 12 positive results among players and staff, the highest figure since August. And before we end part two, Tim got in touch to say, spare a thought for the friends and family of Marvin Morgan, who died suddenly, aged just 38. He was a popular cult hero during his time here at Shrewsbury, he says. And at others too, I'm sure, remain on good terms with the club, was still involved in community work here this summer. He began a successful clothing business during his playing days. Tributes have poured in from players who play far higher up the football pyramid than he ever did, gone far too soon. We, of course, send our best wishes to his family and friends, and we'll be back in a second. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Monday Night Football, which always seems so long ago, was Everton beating Arsenal 2-1. Damari Gray, Lars, what a hit that was.
He's good, isn't he, Damari Gray? You know, but of course, when you see a player who very, very much struggled to make an impact in the Bundesliga play so well in the Premier League, you really do wonder about the standard of the division these days. Could be that it's not very good at all, Max. I mean, isn't that how these conversations go?
I think. Are you worried about the Premier League?
Yes,
Lars?
Very. I mean, it's about? Just clearly. I mean, he was never couldn't really get in the team at Leverkusen, and look at him go. You know, it's clearly too easy for him here. No, he was very, very good. I think. It was probably not a necessarily bad thing for Everton that they tried with the Richarlison lone striker thing. God bless Salomon Rondon, but it hasn't really looked like working for him. Unfortunately, being a big Salomon Rondon truther, I'm going to have to admit defeat there for all the success I've had in the Sebastian Allaire's terrific society. I can't think of anything for Rondon on the fly, but the Rondon lounge, whoever they are, it's not been good. Watching this game, it was kind of weird because Arsenal were kind of in control. They had a lot of possession. You know, they took the lead, but they seemed very intent on letting Everton back into the game somehow, which was a little bit disappointing from their perspective, I have to say.
Am I the only person on earth who thought that Ben Godfrey didn't mean to stamp on Tomiyasu's head?
I'm on the fence on that one. I can see the point that you can't really prove it, and it is close to. So I saw one referee saying basically you can't know if it was intentional, and it looked like it might not have been. And then I spoke to another ref who said it was 100% a red card. So I have no idea what I meant to think.
Because obviously intent doesn't matter, but presumably if someone's head's on the floor, intent does matter, because if you land and you have to put your foot somewhere. But like, I mean, I got sort of dragged along by my ankles on social media for suggesting that Ben Godfrey didn't know what he was doing, and then it was like a no look stamp, like a no. And Ben Godfrey doesn't do no look passes, does he? Like he's not that. He's not that kind of player.
Godfrey, they called him.
Earlier on in that game, he'd gone flying into a tackle as well. True. You can't always link the two incidents, but he seemed very pumped up. I mean, there was a VAR check on that tackle, you know, even before the stamp. So I think it was a red card.
Okay. I'm happy to have my mind changed. I didn't lose sleep over it. After I got home from the Ben Woodburn rave, what of Arsenal, Jonathan? I mean, the Arsenal fans were very disappointed. I mean, Lars is right. I thought they were really bad after they'd gone ahead in a sort of...
They're so meek.
Yeah. What is it about... What did you think, Jonathan? I thought they were rubbish.
I think the main criticism of Arsenal at the moment is around the manager, in the sense of they tend to go ahead in games and then just assume that they've won the match and kind of sit back and wait to win it 1-0, and then they don't. That's kind of like the feedback I'm getting from Arsenal fans and that kind of thing. My Arsenal fan panel that I have in my house. But no, but you know, they did the same obviously against Manchester.
That sounds incredibly annoying.
Hang on, do you live with AFTV? Are they on that? Are they in the next room on those well-spaced chairs like that, yelling?
If I've learned anything about Arsenal fans on the internet, is I do not want to have a panel of them in my house.
They've all got a place on my couch and they all give me feedback regularly. You know, they did the same thing against Manchester United, of course. You know, they kind of looked as if at one point they were going to win, and then they didn't. And I think it's become a recurring theme with Arteta, and that kind of feeling that when they've got the advantage, they don't really go for it. They kind of become a bit conservative once they go up, and it's probably going to cost them. I think this season is Arsenal have a huge advantage in the fact they have no European football. I mean, it's kind of almost gone underplayed how bad it is to not be in Europe when you've got like 15 European tournaments this season. You know, that you could, you know, even if you don't qualify in a Conference League, you've got some sort of get out clause via some sort of playoff to stay in Europe. So it's almost impossible not to be in Europe. And obviously the freshness that they can have from that, you know, not having as many games gives them a real advantage. That you know, you wonder if they're going to take advantage of it when, at the moment, when you look at the table, they're obviously in seventh. I think the pressure will start to increase on Arteta if this becomes like a common theme. And you know, he kind of goes from really, really safe in his job, gets big results, and then goes to kind of a bit insecure. And it's hard to really figure out what's going on there at Arsenal, if they're really committed to him or is it kind of game by game basis. And they've also got other issues to deal with. Like Aubameyang, you know, the captain not starting and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I thought they were much better against Manchester United, but it's interesting you mentioned Aubameyang, because he had that really, he had not an easy chance, but a chance that prime Aubameyang would have scored in injury time, Lars.
Yes, he did. And he does seem to have, I mean, I know it's a bit of a, I don't think it's necessarily linked to the contract. I think it's just a case of a striker getting a little bit older. I mean, most strikers slow down a bit as they reach a certain age. But his development since signing his big new contract at Arsenal has not been good. And I still understand why they handed him that contract, because they had kind of backed themselves into a corner where they couldn't let him leave on a free. But it does seem like the exact same thing that happened with Mesut Ozil has perhaps happened with Aubameyang. Now, I'm not suggesting he's going to drop off the radar in quite the same way, but it does seem like Arsenal managed to maneuver themselves into a situation where they were forced between losing a huge asset for nothing or handing him a slightly bigger and longer contract than they really wanted to. It does look like it's happened again, friends. So that's not good. I would also just say about Arsenal, I feel like their results this autumn has been slightly deceptive, because they've been on this long sort of unbeaten in so many games. But like, if you look at who they actually beat in that run, it was like Norwich, Burnley, Tottenham when they were in sort of full Nuno crisis mode, you know, Villa right at the death of the Dean Smith thing. Very lucky to beat Leicester, and then they beat Watford, you know, well done. So it's been a sort of a deceptively rubbish run in terms of the opponents they had. Now, of course, you've got to pick up the points, but we've seen now when they face slightly better opponents that maybe the project isn't quite as far along after all.
The planned 27th minute walkout by Everton didn't really amount to much, did it? I was excited they got a corner, didn't they? I was really hoping they got a penalty just to see, you know, like that would be the real test for you. And look, I can understand why Everton fans are frustrated at the moment. It was to mark 27 years without a trophy come the end of the season. Ben got in touch to say the recent discussion about Everton's protest leaving on 27 minutes to mark 27 years without a trophy couldn't make me think this is surely the least effective way to protest. As a Leicester fan, he says, would I have to leave the game after 1 minute and therefore miss the majority of the match despite the great success in recent years? Obviously, they won the FA Cup, didn't they, last year? Got me wondering about which fans would have to sit through the most amount of football before leaving to protest. A quick search brought me to a 2014 Knowledge article which confirms Rochdale have not won a trophy since 1912, meaning they'd have to sit through an entire match and then 19 minutes of the next before leaving to protest. Surely there has to be a better way. I think you're allowed to come back in, though, aren't you? That's the idea. You leave and then you're allowed to come back in a minute later. I'm not entirely sure. Okay, the FA Cup third round draw took place on Monday. Some really fun draws for some lower league teams. Chesterfield going to Chelsea, Morecambe going to Tottenham, Swindon hosting Manchester City. And the big one, Newcastle versus Cambridge United. Fighting for the forces of goods, we go on, maths. The Amber Army, join us up in the gods. Oh, I'm so excited about this draw. The ties will take place the weekend commencing Friday the 7th, I mean, Saturday the 8th of January, but that's when that's what Graham Kelly would say, until Monday the 10th. Manchester United Aston Villa is an all Premier League tie. Have I missed any other exciting ones? Everton go to Hull.
Yeah, I think Forest against Arsenal, Max, is quite an interesting one, because we were just speaking about Arteta and, you know, that Arsenal project that's going on. If you go out in the third round of the FA Cup when you're not in Europe, and you're maybe a bit off the pace in the top four, then that becomes, I think a real dangerous moment for him. So that's probably the game that I'd be sort of most eagerly sort of keen to watch, because a lot of those that you mentioned are great for the teams involved, but actually they're not the best spectacles, are they? You know, just, you know, watching Chesterfield lose like 4-5-0, but whereas this one, you know, Forest are flying under Steve Cooper, and so that looks like a tricky game. You know, it's absolute banker to be on TV, and that would be the one where you may be looking for an upset.
Watch it on Jonathan's couch with his Arsenal panel, can't you? Shrewsbury going to Liverpool and West Ham Leeds as well. Good ties. Pete says, why did I swagger into your replies, Max, and suggest Wadden Road was a fortress after Joe Ironside's hat-trick gave Cambridge a 5-0 win at Cheltenham? Utterly baffling to watch us score 5 goals in a football match. I didn't really know what to do. Clearly, the highlight, though, of the Football League was Bolton Wanderers' tweet, a duck emoji. Play has just resumed following a brief pause while a couple of members of staff prevented a duck from entering play, which was nice. It doesn't say how they prevent. I presume just kind of herding, two stewards herding the duck is what I imagine. Unless they had a hook, of course, like a fairground ride to pick it up. Robert says, can we get an MLS prediction, final prediction from Lars Sivertsen?
Ronny Dailas, mighty New York City FC will lift the trophy. I figured you want me to keep that brief.
Oh, I don't mind. Who are they playing?
The Portland Timbers.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, I'll be supporting Liam Ridgewell's Portland Timbers. I believe he's commentating now for Timbers FC, or whatever they're called, the Lumberjack Channel. I don't know what it is, but, you know, I like Liam Ridgewell. And he also has his own swimwear design company. So if you want some swimming shorts, ask Liam Ridgewell. Paul says, dear Max and team, I've been a Leeds fan for approaching 50 years. I left the UK for Hong Kong at the beginning of 94, at the start of the Premier League. Since then, there have been a few ups and rather a lot of downs. But having the Premier League back in my life over the last season and a half has been wonderful. Although I've been a devoted Guardian reader for decades, I only started listening to the pod at the start of last season, coinciding with Leeds' return to the top flight. My son and I listen to and from his football training and matches. We love the humour, but also the fact that you don't shy away from tackling some of the more difficult issues surrounding football, Qatar workers' rights, sports washing, etc. My main reason for writing is to question the lack of attention given to David De Gea's retro Teddy Boy haircut on the pod. While he was rolling around on the floor, Smith Rowe booted the ball in the net, I wondered when the last time a footballer sported a Teddy Boy quiff in England's top tier. I have a romantic notion that it was Frank Worthington in the 80s at Leeds, socks rolled around his ankles with a bit of a belly. However, that's flawed because one, it was too thin on top, two, too long at the back, and three, we were, of course, going through one of our rubbish patches languishing in Division 2. Can the pod enlighten us, please? Thanks, Paul. I can't remember the last quiff. I mean, I can't remember the last quiff in the Premier League. Gareth Bale's a quiff? Not really, was it? Jonathan, you have a lot of hair. I mean, you must be an expert on these things. You probably don't know what a teddy boy quiff is, it?
Yeah. Most follically high-charged member of the panel today.
Jonathan Fadouba. Scott Parker, says producer Joel. Yeah, that's quite a good shout. I think go with Scott Parker. Gigsy says, goose fat or beef dripping on Mark's roast potatoes for Christmas?
I prefer beef dripping, but it'd probably be goose fat for Christmas, I would have thought.
All right. Pete says, can we get a detailed breakdown of exactly what Mark will be having for Christmas lunch? I'm going for an expected vegetables EV of 0.37, although turkey stuffing and pigs in blankets are sure to dominate the plate possession.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're going to end up like Brighton of last season there, really, where you don't hit the real vegetable, doesn't it? The expected vegetable. I'll probably go none for Christmas. There's just too many other good things to have on there. I mean, you know, you've got your staple of turkey plus another meat. So I'm not sure which other meat will go, but we'll have two meats. There will be roast potatoes, Yorkshire puddings, which is a little bit controversial on the Christmas dinner, but I'll probably have a big bit of that. And then, you know, just fill the rest of the plate with pigs in blankets. I don't think I need anything else, really. Else would you have? You've got all the good
you're
things.
Fine. Pigs in blankets. Yeah. Pigs in blankets are the star without knowing, you know, you don't think of them as the star.
Well, I do think though, Max, that, you know, I never understand why people only have them at Christmas. It doesn't make any sense to me. Like if you like pigs in blankets, just eat them sort of, I don't have them every Sunday, but I wouldn't be against it sort of, you know, with most roast dinners.
For breakfast. Okay.
But I do think there's something to having seasonal foods, no? To have something that you have only by one occasion, because it adds to sort of the grandeur of the occasion.
If I like something, I eat it, and that's sort of my that's my approach.
There's
that's
a T-shirt.
I have a type of meatball that I only make at Christmas every year, by a particular recipe. Or it's kind of meatball. I mean, medistakaka, we say in Norwegian, which I, from my old great-great-grandmother's recipe that I make on the night before Christmas every year and no other time of year, ever.
Oh. Dave says, since watching the live pod, I've enjoyed eating pears again. It was easy to explain to my girlfriend that I just had a craving for them. Rather than explain, I watched a retired ex-Pompey and others, Steve Claridge, eat a bowl of fruit during a podcast break. Well, glad to at least get a listener on some fruit and vegetables if we can't get the panel on. And the Blue Magpie says, is being castled first ball a better or worse start to an Ashes series than bowling the first ball to second slip?
I saw that. I thought I'd watched the start of it. I don't really get the cricket, but sometimes I make an effort, and I thought I'd watch the start of the Ashes, and I did watch the first ball, and I have to say it was quite entertaining, just in terms of a very action-packed. I wasn't expecting to get that much out of that first delivery, so that was I appreciated that, at least.
That'll do for today. Thank you, Jonathan.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Lars.
Thank you very much, Max.
We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.